All right, here we are once again, episode 8, featuring the return of Brian Russo. Rob and I are very excited. Hello, gentlemen.
Well, thanks for inviting me back. So I guess I did at least one thing right last time.
The fans demanded that we bring you back, Brian. Cool. So one thing we are going to do today as a quick speed round, there's been a lot flurry of LinkedIn posts from the group here this week. And so we are going to pick one from each and just give a few more thoughts on that. Get the opinions of the group, see what we can learn, do things useful for people out there. Brian?
Sure. So, I mean, I've actually been a little more active on LinkedIn recently, and Rob would know I have some cynicism about LinkedIn as a platform, but I think it's an interesting place to explore narratives, and there's definitely some value you can get out of it. And so one post I put in recently was actually something that's been on my mind for a number of years as I've kind of sort of evolved in roles and whatnot. And it was really kind of about this interface between giving candid feedback. And I'm really curious, especially what Rob has to think about this, but in the past I had approached the idea about giving people sort of, candid, as I would say, brutal feedback. And I think brutal is a key term there. As being necessarily diametrically opposed to, being pleasant or nice, I had this idea in my head, which I've recognized as false, that you were kind of either sort of giving people sort of honest, candid feedback, or you were going to be nice to them. And, over the years, I've recognized that it's obviously far more nuanced than that. I mean, that's a very overly simplistic way of thinking about it. And really trying to introduce compassion into, a lot of my communications and sort of reshaping how I think of the purpose of communication is less about being to inform and more about generating impact. One of my favorite kind of quotes, and I think this is apocryphal, I have no idea who it's attributed to, but
Mark Twain.
It probably is Mark Twain, or if not, we can say Einstein. That's always a good one too. Yeah. But it's the fallacy of a person to, be right rather than be effective. And that's been a very sticky idea for me. There's often times where there's a certain thing you want to say, but if it's not going to generate the right effect, then, you need to kind of reframe your communication. And obviously, for those of us with a military background, this kind of starts to sort of border into information operations and deception. But I think it has applicability just across the spectrum. And it really just comes back to, if you're in some sort of leadership role, which I think, most of us are to some extent, then you're always to some extent going to be mentoring, whether you're communicating up or down. And I think just, introducing some compassion and developing those sort of EQ skills can go a long way to kind of get you to the next level.
Have you done that lately or had some conversation recently that you think to yourself, oh, that's different than how I would have handled it before?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been dealing with, some internal projects I've been working on. And, initially I was very frustrated because I was thinking to myself, this approach is all wrong. This isn't how I would do it.
And this is internal to who, to what?
Internal to a project I'm working on. So,
okay.
But I initially sort of fell back into those old bad habits of, oh, I need to tell them what's correct. I was back to the fallacy of being obsessed with correctness. And so I thought about it for a day or two, right? And I realized, okay, how can I find the opportunity in this to improve my communication skills while also kind of mentoring them? And so, long story short, I tweaked my approach, and about a week into this project now, I'm already seeing results. It's a lot more, there's a lot more of us and the project team kind of moving forward together and not sort of being, directed at each other. And really, it was just overcoming, again, sometimes you have to relearn the same lesson multiple times, this idea of what the purpose of communication is, and recognizing that a lot of the frustrations I had, they actually shared them as well. They just weren't quite as adept at communicating them. So I had to kind of go that extra mile to bridge the gap. And but now we're all kind of, moving out as a cohort in what I think is the right direction.
I learned two things around that recently. What you said, if someone else can do something 80% as well as you could, let it ride. Like that's 1,000% better, because it takes 0% of your time, and the thing will get done. And you know what? It's close enough. It doesn't have to be exactly what you would have done. It could even be better,
Absolutely.
but if you at least feel there's a reasonable chance it'll be okay, then just let it go. And then the other thing I learned of, you got a lot in your head, and people only hear what comes out of your mouth.
Right.
So, and they don't hear what's
Absolutely.
in your head. And so I've had a number of situations lately where I'll say, like, oh man, like this is a disaster. There's that problem and that problem. And people will say, why are you so negative? I'm like, what are you talking about? Like,
Right.
I'm just pointing out these things we have to fix on our way to victory. Yeah, but because it was so firmly inside my head, well, of course this is going to work.
Right.
But the only thing that I was verbalizing were the problems. And so that's something I'm trying to practice now. If you need to
It's so true.
explicitly say up front,
Yeah.
we're going to get there. However, in order to do that, we have to address, these things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very easy. I think if you're like me, it sounds like you're also a very sort of problem solving, oriented type of mindset. And what helped me was realizing that. So I used to think of those sort of communication dissonances and challenges as sort of being like, to borrow a term from Six Sigma, kind of like process waste, right? But I started thinking of them as just as that is part of the task, right? Is bringing everyone with you. It's inadequate if, hey, you may have the right solution. It may be feasible. It may be exactly what you need to do. But if you can't orient everyone towards it and get them there, it doesn't matter, right? And that's the critical skill. And I no longer, I mean, of course, we all still get frustrated about it at times, but I no longer think of it as okay, that's something extra that I have to do. I'm like that is, a sort of a sibling part of delivering that overall solution. And I really like something you said as well, that whole 80% comment, because I've applied that a little differently. But it really is a corollary, when I'm working with junior folks, very often it's the same thing of, hey, I look at a given task and I'm like, gosh, I could probably do that in like 20 minutes and maybe it'll take them an entire day. And it's not because I'm necessarily, smarter or anything like that. It's because I'm familiar with it. To your point, I have a lot of that context in my mind. But what I started realizing is, well, there's a scaling conversation in here and a sustainability conversation. And I don't mean it in a sort of green way, but I mean in an organizational culture way. If, I think the goal for a lot of us, especially, and I'm curious what Rob has to say about this, because he's very big into establishing new projects. But when you're creating a new thing, it's not just about creating the thing. You also want to create that culture and sort of institutionalize it so that when you leave, it will carry forward. And to your point, Mark, like it's going to shift a little bit, it's going to shift a little bit to the left and a little bit to the right as more people pile on with their own ideas. And that's totally fine, right? I mean, that's a great thing. That means that now you have this mass of people that are kind of moving in this new direction, and they're going to be far more successful than you would as just kind of a solopreneur.
Dude, it's so funny you like went right to culture. That I unkeyed my mic a little bit earlier, my mute button, and that's exactly what I wanted to key on, where it's like, the less you invest in culture, sometimes you don't have the option, right? Sometimes it's associated with convenience or recency or something. Like you said, you have a new project, it's kind of a mercenary type situation where you join this group of people you normally don't build with. Like sometimes you don't have the option to invest in culture, but a lot of people kind of overlook or kind of look away from the culture advocates that are like, hey, we need to invest in these things, right? It's totally a practical investment to kind of take a formal approach to the way an organization organizes their culture, and depending on how big the organization is, depending on how many people are kind of interacting with that culture, that system. like, is the indicator of how much you have to invest in it. So something I wanted to point out was like, how do you operationalize your culture so you don't have to spend so much on communication and getting everything right and making sure every conversation is like very delicate and curated and created in this custom way? Because that's expensive, like you were saying. Like, the more you invest in culture, the more you operationalize culture, the more you turn culture into a utility, the cheaper it's going to be to have interactions that lead to success, in my opinion, where it's like, rather than being so scared about, saying the wrong things so people stop listening to you or always seeming like the negative person, everyone's just focused on finding the next puzzle piece to complete the puzzle. And that's what everything's about. And that just takes reps. People are complicated, but that's like the ultimate goal of being able to operationalize culture.
One thing it was hitting me as you were saying that was, that this notion of if people could think to themselves, this thing that I'm saying to this person right now, if they were saying it to me, how would I react or what would I think? And I think what help people realize when they're saying something out of a power dynamic, for example, if I've seen a lot of, managers and leaders sometimes that will say things to, their teams or employees as if, and they may even believe it, that they're just one of the folks on the team. But really, if they were hearing that from one of their people was saying it to them, they would be like, "Don't tell me what to do," Oh, and then they would help realize, "Oh, wait, I actually am telling people what to do. I'm not, I'm using my power. It's only because of this position that I'm able to say what I'm saying and get away with it."
Yeah,
I think that might be a useful exercise.
that power dynamic piece is really powerful. And the prior organization I was at a number of years ago, we did this really interesting exercise, and it would take too long to explain it, but essentially what it boiled down to is they kind of bin people as being sort of more extrovertish or more introvertish, and of course that's its own can of worms to kind of pull that apart in detail. But basically what it turned into is they put the people such as myself that tend to be more outspoken in one group, and they put the people that were more reserved socially in another group, and they gave us a set of challenges. It was a whole kind of half day exercise type of thing. The ideas, I would say unequivocally, from the more reserved group were more refined, they were better articulated, and they were far less messy than what we came up with. I think we both kind of came up with okay solutions, but my takeaway from that wasn't so much that they had, quote unquote, better solutions. It was that there was a wealth of solution knowledge, sort of buried in those people. And so that what I took away from that is someone such as myself, who is, less afraid to be outspoken and to take that risk and to, maybe occasionally get shot in the face, part of my responsibility is to sort of, act more actively, work with those people and really pull ideas out of them. So I've been applying that, over the years since. I of course I still, I'm not perfect at it, but it's become a very powerful technique to just, actively solicit from, people in meetings or in engagements, because you'll always be surprised by what you hear from someone that perhaps is the most reserved. It doesn't mean they don't have anything to say. You just need to kind of work with them and their communication style to pull out that knowledge.
Rob, what was your top post?
I guess I have a final point on that last topic while I connect it to one of my posts. And I kind of dealt with this, in two different settings, right? Like the tactical product trenches, you're working with a team. I'm often in a situation where I'm capturing requirements through design, engineers that are building things. And then we're trying to knife fight around like what features get prioritized and why, how are the features attacked and addressed? How do we avoid gold plating? And we've already established a ton of kind of culture on the team. Like I have that situation. Then I also have like the enterprise situation where you're negotiating or trying to get somebody to invest their time, resources into something that you think they'll need. And so it's really funny. I think like it always comes down to like understanding what that individual values that you're trying to negotiate with and work with and summarize something for. And so, engineering wise, there was just like in my mind, like we were kind of both on a it started on a stand-up call and ended up in something that spilled over after stand-up, where we were kind of like negotiating and arguing for an approach for a particular feature that we both had like really strong opinions about. And you know, I in my mind there was like, and we ended up going to a whiteboard where I was just like kind of listing out all the different options and what happens if we go different directions. And in my mind, like you can see when someone's just shutting down and they're like only going to do one thing. Like the worst outcome that could happen is if you go with that person's direction, but you share the risk with them. The only way to kind of negotiate and kind of train certain behaviors where people are like very diligent and thoughtful and kind of team focused rather than like just we're going to launch off my opinion, you have to get people to own the risk. So tactically, I literally just I knew there was a threshold we weren't going to get past where I wasn't going to win, where it was just like, all right, let's totally go with that. I'll literally adjust like my entire design backlog to solve this problem that you have, or the or to validate this assumption you have, but you own this. Like this is yours. I will support it 100%, but nobody else is catching the flack if you miscalculate. And then people start to like negotiate in a more kind of currency related way where they take discussions more seriously. On the other side of the house, when it comes to the enterprise level, when you're communicating to them and you're trying to determine, you know, what they deem as valuable or whatever, it literally just comes down to just being like totally transparent with them. Like I've communicated to C-suite people, like honestly, just like I recommend doing X, Y, and Z because of this data, and it'll make you rich, period dot. Like you're gonna get wealthier. I have no equity in your company. Like you are measurably going to have better revenue numbers for when you want to exit or get a PE injection in 2 years. It's like that simple. And they respond really well to that because we're not like playing games. I'm not trying to like summarize things or like layer on top of it. It's very straightforward. And anytime you're not, I feel like anytime you don't understand or can't summarize what people think is valuable or what kind of makes sense to them, you end up like just almost living in this like weird tactical PR campaign where you're just like not having honest conversations about things. So I was hopefully trying to use that to bridge into another topic as I talk mad smack all the time on LinkedIn. But I actually, you know what? I'm gonna pivot really quickly. Similar topic, similar thrashy, you know, emo band type post from Rob. But there was one post I got, which is funny because like it also goes to like, do people want to like your posts and stuff because they feel like uncomfortable representing a particular message or brand? But one I was like super passionate about this week was just because a lot of the things the government, like bless the government, I'm going to stop saying the public sector. It's really the DoD. A lot of the things the DoD does kind of poorly, and you know, I think both of you will appreciate this, especially Brian. I was talking to him earlier about a topic. But it's kind of like this like regurgitation of jargon to make people to blend into a community so people kind of like don't isolate you, don't pick you out. It's like comfortable to just say always be ready to say the right thing because you never actually have to do anything. And that's like this really dangerous theme and cultural component to DoD technology modernization, which is unfortunate, right? That's why, you know, and I'm not just like this whiny character. It's like you close your eyes and you think of how many SaaS products are actually successfully contributing to operational outcomes. And there's probably very few. There's like very specific systems and programs of record you could think of. And then there's a bunch of like marketecture, vaporware, weird stories that are tied to slogans that aren't real things yet. And you start going deep on these things, and it's just so uninspiring because you realize they're all like left of proof of concept. And it's like, oh, that's not even like running yet. It's like a PowerPoint. It's like, you know, the number, the money that was associated with these programs. And it's just like, it's really uninspiring when you're like someone who wants to see progress because you realize national security kind of is the fabric that like gives us the runway in every other category in society. So the post that I made was around digital transformation and like, one of the issues with program offices is there's this obsession with constantly changing the narrative and story and like living through some like marketing messaging rather than execution, which is like way harder than like something that's just like an inspiring like possibility. And so digital transformation is always about like ripping these organizations apart, changing everything, spending all of this money, change like reshuffling the characters around. And we just end up in this like endless cycle every 3 years of like completely changing everything, swapping jargon out, but like nothing ever like actually gets implemented. And so my post was around like, there's actually an opportunity to just like carefully join a program, understand their target market. Sometimes in the DoD, it's like an operational target market. But for one use case that I'm involved in, it's like kind of like a commodity market, like with the Space Force and stuff. Like it's things you can research publicly and really understand how you could impact that system with software and like protect jobs, help people do more with less. And instead of like, and but that takes like, you know, actual diligence and hardcore research and stuff. A lot of people are just incentivized in our ecosystem to like roll in there, break everything apart, like arbitrarily, try to reset from scratch, live on whiteboards, and then like ever like there's no incentive to jump into the trenches and execute. So I threw that post out there where it was like, you don't have to break everything apart in order to start kind of like making progress and optimizing things. Sometimes you need to just launch, embed yourself, learn about the target market, and change little things here and there in preparation for kind of like the big bang, no pun intended, where you could potentially like affect something in like a more chaotic, generational type of way.
Yeah, what happened is the whole strangler fig pattern, is that not being used at DoD? I know we, you know, remember before we used that quite a bit on the civilian side, you know,
Yeah.
in the digital transformation efforts. But I would have
It's a
thought that would have been also involved at DoD.
strangler, and that's another thing. Like, strangler fig is really tied to like someone who's self-aware and like wants to execute, and it doesn't consider like a lot of the political things and the way money works in the DoD and stuff. It's also kind of unique too, because like there's, you know, certain legacy systems that just exist that aren't operationally adopted anymore, so they're like kind of outside of the tree. It's like weird if you're like looking at the strangler fig pattern. It's like from a marketing and information perspective, theoretically this system is still on paper, and if you were to sit at a terminal, you can log into it. So people think it's mapped to a particular operational workflow, but it's not. And people don't want to shed like point a light at that, because like their contract will go away. They won't have people like sitting around looking at like green, yellow, and red markers for when the system goes down type stuff. And so it's like there's layers of complexity to doing product right or just doing systems right in the DoD that has nothing to do with like architecture or engineering. It's like all like, can you figure out the reality of the situation? Can you convince people in a way that doesn't completely isolate them and make them look silly? And like it's so many soft skills. If the objective of your journey is to like actually create a utility that people can depend on and use day in and day out, to get there just takes so many things outside of just like understanding the tech. And that's another element that I don't think people take as seriously as they should.
Rob, there's lots to unpack there, obviously, but one thing it's kind of, we were talking about the Agile conversation earlier, and one thing I've been thinking about a lot is, I'm curious, how much do you think like just simple group identity and the desire to belong, right, factors into this? Because I think that's a huge sort of unintended consequence of a lot of this sort of hunger and demand signal for innovation in DoD is, I think to your point, a lot of that was intended to transform into those mission outcomes, but the unintended consequences instead been there's this huge demand signal to message, wow, look at my project, look at how innovative it is, look at, you know, we're using AI, we're doing all those things. And that's a how you do something. That's not the so what, right? But unfortunately, there's so much, you know, interest alignment with messaging that, oh, we're being all hip and cool and transforming and look at our, you know, our Google pods and all this type of stuff, but that isn't sort of transforming into those actual outcomes. So there's a lot of messaging, you know. So to your point, it's an alignment, but I just wonder how much of that really just comes down to just basic human psychology and this
Totally.
need that's been inserted in the mind of people of, oh, I need to become hip and I need to become part of that kind of SV ecosystem.
Dude, I have to follow up. Yeah, no, 1,000,000%. Like, dude, that is exactly what it is. And it's such a challenging thing for anyone to wrangle, right? Say you have some dogmatic leader that just wants to like make the US military more lethal, or wants to make HHS provide health services better than any other like government health service body in the world. Like, there's so many things they're competing with what you just described, where this like whole label of innovation, like is just so elusive because nobody A wants to define it. Like we get as a community say this is what innovation is. If you're not doing X, Y, and Z, you're not like actually contributing to meaningful innovation. It's like theater, it's marketing. If anything, you're stealing value from the system because it's confusing people. Obviously identifying like people's actions, activities, and the time that they're utilizing, what's the impact on that, on the success of like whatever the defined success is or whatever the defined innovation is, really comes down to like organizations not wanting to define objectives and like an accountability fabric for themselves, right? So like
Accountability.
because if there isn't, like why impose accountability on yourself? Like when you're going to be able to maneuver more freely and be able to kind of write your own success with like the whole OPR workflow where you can just like invent kind of and exaggerate like weird situations. Like why be tied to expectations, right? Like
Well,
there's
there's
no
an interesting
incentive.
tough premise too in what you're saying is, accountability, to your point, like it's like something everyone wants to avoid. But there's a tough premise in there, which I think we all understand, but it's worth hammering on, which is that failure is a good thing. We should be seeking it more often. It's just that we should be also concurrently be seeking to mitigate. And then this gets back to the Agile conversation is if you fail, that's useful data, but that's not how failure is seen in DoD. Nobody wants to fail,
Of
right? It's
course.
like, we all see these, military exercises where, like a this is a dated example, but like a Dutch submarine will sink a carrier or something like that. And you know what? That usually turns into a, we're going to roll that back. And I was like, no, that's a learning opportunity,
Dude, really quick, but it's
embedded
like
in that failure.
we're like 4D chessing our yeah, dude, we're 4D chessing ourselves because like the military doesn't want to deal with failure. They should have like a reasonable way and a cultural viewpoint of like appreciating failure to learn from it. And then you wrap all of that with them outwardly saying that fail fast, agile stuff, like you know what I'm saying? Where they're marketing one thing, they don't actually believe that thing, but they should believe that thing in an authentic way in order to get a higher ROI for the warfighter and the taxpayer and stuff. So it's like this crazy, like, you know, multi-level thing that like nobody can recognize and put down on paper. I honestly think one of the most valuable things the DoD can do is like a like case study on like leadership behavioral psychology and the types of people that end up in these roles at every level, right? It's not generals, it's generals, it's action officers, it's kind of junior leaders. It's just so interesting to unpack all of that. But yeah, it's extremely wasteful and extremely complex to solve, you know. It's just yeah, it really comes down to accountability and tracking objectives. 'Cause if you're not doing that, it allows anyone to just kind of create their own worlds, and it becomes tribal, and it's pointless, really. Like, because the people that depend on those outcomes and those objectives being achieved, like, don't get the output from those activities.
No, one closing thought because I can't resist, and I encourage anyone watching this. There's a great video on YouTube called "Why Our Generals Were More Successful in World War II," and it's by Thomas Ricks, and he touches on something that you just described. And actually, I realized I was talking about in my previous anecdote as well, is this idea of these this false continuum, right? Because that's kind of what you're talking with failure, is this idea that failure is good or bad, and he talks about basically this idea that accountability that. In World War II, they didn't fire generals like permanently. If they failed, they kind of pushed them out, but then they would use that as an opportunity to learn, and then they would come back. And that's something we need to get away from, is this idea that failure is a dirty word. Certain tech communities, they have concept of like a blame-free postmortems and stuff like that, and it's this idea that you should learn from failure. So if there's one thing I would do just to close this thought, it's that we need as a community to start learning from failure. And not treating it as something to be avoided that's gonna ruin someone's DSIPs.
I think my post was inspired retroactively by this conversation, somehow went back through the ether, around, you know, again, this notion of like, why are people doing things that don't seem to make sense? And it was, again, I'm sure someone said this before, but like it was inspired by some conversations I had had during that day where just people were not making sense what they were saying, and we were just fighting and brawling. And finally, one of the people said, like, hey, you know, come on, we got to get this together. Our job is to do X. And suddenly it was like, oh, here's the problem. That's why you're acting like that. If my job actually was to do X as well, I would be doing acting exactly like you. However, my job is to do Y. And so that's why I don't make any sense to you. Like this isn't that we're not understanding each other. We're understanding each other very well. We just have different incentives, basically. Like you get paid when this happens. I get paid when this happens. And once we kind of got that into the open, we're like, okay, great. How do we both, achieve this goal? Like, because clearly if we work together on this, there will be a better chance to succeed at the mission overall, and then we'll both get what we're incented on. But suddenly everybody's behaviors completely made a lot more sense once we put out there again what our incentives are. And so like even to like this failure thing, to the general, perhaps, yeah, even if they're fine with, yes, team, it's okay for you to fail. If there's someone on that team who is trying to get a promotion and their, manager is on that group and they, fail at that thing, and based on their goals, they will then suffer, then suddenly, they're not going to be as okay with failure, because that's how they're incented. So I think, step one of get everyone incentives on the table, and because you may even have some that are literally in direct conflict. And so you definitely have to deal with that. But most of the time, I think it will be just more, okay, our incentives are close enough such that if we achieve this goal, you get the thighs, you get the legs, you get, you like it'll be fine. We just have to catch, the turkey. And so that I think can work really well. And so I think the theme kind of all this is really just, Brian, what you and I were talking about before we started, of like being, you have to be explicit in your communication. Thoughts in your head don't do anyone any good. Like get everything out on the table up front, because when you're in the heat of things, emotions are high, tensions are there, it's harder. But if at least you start with, here's what I'm dealing with, you can generally put together a better plan.
And that's a lot like what you were talking about with that 80% thing. And I think what we're all saying is very interesting because we've all sort of converged on the same topic. It all comes back to, balancing accountability, balancing compassion. It happens every time. But yeah, I mean, I've always kind of thought about it. I'm a geographer at the end of the day, despite all the other hats I've worn. And so I tend to think of things in terms of surfaces and landscapes. And it's like, if you think of that, org chart across the different dimensions, it's like really, I think what a lot of what you're saying is powerful is that we all need to understand and develop that empathy and compassion to what the people adjacent to us are doing. So that, I was watching something the other day. I've already recounted this last time, but it's back to this idea that, if you're an airline pilot. And an ATC or someone doing a ride along, I think police and dispatchers do the same thing. It's that whole live in their shoes, right? Develop that empathy so that, as you had said, you can see it from their perspective. And that's very powerful.
It totally is. Like, I could jump into a whole topic around like there needs to be a workflow product for this exact kind of system that we're loosely describing, because it really is a system. It's so funny. Well, like while you were describing, kind of some of the like difference of incentives and how you're trying to work with people across your organization, it made me think of like the typical sales to product handoff or sales to ops handoff, where sales is incentivized to like pitch certain things, and their description of certain things could be a little bit more ambitious when it comes to roadmaps and timing of features. And so they can accrue a ton of risk and throw it over the wall to somebody else that has to deal with it, but they capture their incentive currency, right? Their actual revenue. They've sold. That's all that matters. They've turned a qualified lead into a buyer. And so I think even just like empathizing with each other, kind of zooming out and just understanding how humans operate, there's a level of leadership that needs to be involved, where there's someone in between those different layers of your system or components of your system, like you were saying, Brian, like the whole service overlay piece, that kind of creates that governance between these teams. So there aren't, these handoffs that create more waste and more stovepipes and more issues, where teams are now arguing with sales and sales feels unsafe to like phrase things a certain way. I mean, the ripple effect is tremendous, but I really feel like there could be an incredible platform opportunity here to create a backlog mechanism that takes people through this journey and accounts for all the realistic incentives of each participant.
And in fact, probably a fantastic topic for the next episode. Because, probably Mark Twain's most famous quote, keep it tight. So I think it's time to wrap it up. This has been great. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity again.